The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 5 of this 5-day session here at Hidden Valley Zen Center in July 2017. And yesterday we spoke of Rinzai and his teachings, Rinzai being the person whose name is at the top of the Rinzai lineage of Zen, the Rinzai sect of Zen. And now we'll take on his teacher, Huangpo. We don't know the dates of the birth of either of these men. We do know approximately when they died. Huangpo died in 850, which was during the Golden Age of Zen, and Rinzai died 17 years later. It was said that Rinzai died young, in his 50s possibly. Huangpo, on the other hand, seems to have lived a long and productive life. The Golden Age of Zen, which went up to the 900s in China, was several centuries long, and included several periods of extreme persecution of Buddhists. It was a time of great movement, let's put it that way, psychological, physiological, political, all, you name it. There was a lot of things happening in China during that period of time. It was not so different from our own time in a certain way. Many inventions came forth. I believe that was when gunpowder was invented, was during the Golden Age of Zen, among many other things. And of course, now here we have all this technological stuff, this digital stuff, the internet, cell phones, and so on and so forth. More inventions here, all of it speeding up life and all of it changing life from how it was prior to these inventions, the same way as it was in China. And it is times like these, when things are not going along smoothly and easily, that people can get bounced out of their usual frame of mind. And that can produce, in the positive direction, a great deal of creativity, invention, enlightenment. And on the other direction, it can create a lot of inner chaos. Well, there's inner chaos regardless, I think, at least in the beginning. And so it was a time of a number of great Zen masters coming forth. And of course, one of them was Obaku, another was Rinzai, another was Tungshang Liangzhi, another was Zhoushu. There were a number, an extraordinary number, really, for the time period, of greatly enlightened Zen masters who were leading students to profound awakening. So Obaku, unlike some of the other famous masters of the era, had a student, Pei Xu, who was a government official. And Pei Xu trained with him a number of significant times. And each time he had an encounter with Obaku, he recorded it. Of course, he's recording it with a brush and paper in those days. No recording machines other than your own hand. And so we have, unlike with those other masters, we have a more extensive record of Huangpo's words. And they were, some of them quite, well, most of them quite deep, and I'd like to share some of them with you. Pei Xu, of course, being a government official, was a highly intellectual, and for a long, long time, China has had, perhaps until the more recent communist era, a tradition, millennia-old tradition, of examinations to become a government executive. And in fact, the six patriarchs' father was one such government official centuries before, and these government officials were not always benign and obedient officials. They were sometimes had their own ideas and were perceived as a threat to the rulers of the time, the emperor or whoever happened to be in charge. And that was the case with the six patriarchs, with Hui Neng's father. And so he was exiled to a remote area. But Pei Xu, as far as we know, lived also a long life, and in fact he lived a longer life, or at least he died after Huang Po did. And so there's a tremendous body of information about their encounters. And here's one. Pei Xu presented Huang Po with a poem that was one of the classic things of high society, perhaps you might call it, in China. And of course that tradition of presenting a poem has come down into present day Japan, so that Haruhiro Roshi presents a poem in the classic Chinese form and using the exclusively Chinese characters. There's no Japanese characters involved in it, although he speaks it in Japanese. On the occasion of, for example, the beginning and the ending of a sesshin and other events, New Year's Eve, so on and so forth. As far as I know, it has not continued particularly into the United States, mainly because we don't normally traditionally study Chinese poetry or Chinese language as part of our Zen training. And speaking of Zen training, I want to alert you all to some news that I've just received. There is a book that was the account by Tore Enji, who was Hakuin's primary Dharma successor, actually, at a very young age. I think he was 26 when he got transmission. And he was a deeply enlightened man. Now, at 26 getting transmission, he actually started Zen practice when he was considerably younger. I think he was a young teenager when he was drawn to practice and became a monk. And you've heard before that he became ill. It may have been this stress-related illness. There are some other thoughts that it actually might have been TB. Japan is a rather damp, cold country, and there's not a lot of heat available in that country in the winter. And it can be ripe conditions for developing TB, and many people over the centuries have. At any rate, the doctors gave up on him, and so he decided that if he's going to die, he will do what he can to rest and take care of himself, and at the same time, he would, as that allowed, write down everything he understood about Zen practice. The result is the inexhaustible lamp, it's called. And this was translated along with a translation of a 20th century Rinzai master's commentary on it, Daibi, by a German woman, Myokyo Ni, who was a sanctioned Rinzai Zen teacher who taught at the Zen Center in London. She had trained for, I think, 11 or 12 years at, I think it may have been Nanzenji, and one of the Rinzai headquarter temples in Japan, in an era when they were really doing authentic training, and received transmission, and then went to London to teach. And she, along with a Japanese woman, translated these two texts and did a marvelous translation, excellent translation. And I was just checking the American Zen Teacher Association listserv for messages, and this came up. This is a book that in the regular Western publication is long out of print, and it is extremely pricey, $500 for the book. And I just learned that because the Zen Center of London still holds the rights to the book, they are making it available to people. You can buy it on the web. It's 19 and some pounds per copy, which is far less than $500. And it is currently available. And I would strongly advise anyone doing serious Zen practice to get a copy. I can put the link in the next Oak Tree, or if you would like it sooner than that, because the next Oak Tree won't come out for another couple of months, I'm happy to email it to you. In fact, perhaps we could just email it to the whole Sangha, because it's definitely worth, if you're going to buy one book to inspire you in your Zen practice and guide you in your Zen practice, that's the book to buy. So, anyway, I've diverged a bit from the subject here. So, Paisu presented Huangpo with a poem. And here's what happened. He took it in his hands, but soon sat down and pushed it away. "Do you understand?" he asked. "No, master." "But why don't you understand? Think a little. If things could be expressed like this with ink and paper, what would be the purpose of a sect like ours?" If things could be expressed like this with ink and paper, what would be the purpose of a sect like ours? Zen practice. The process of coming to awakening is one that demands going beyond words. Yet, we try over and over and over again to explain it. We're more comfortable with explanations than we are with going into the unknown within. And yet, that's how we have to reach it. It's the only way we can reach it, really, is to go deep within, in a wordless search, allowing the yearning that has brought us to Zen practice to pull us deep within, over and over and over again. And the more we do it, the more we are willing to let go of our ideas of who we are, our attachment to that self-image, and little by little we become free. It's not the kind of search that people are accustomed to. We're accustomed to getting out a book, going to the library, going onto the internet these days, typing in a phrase and seeing what comes up, and then exploring the different links. And there's a lot of words involved, trying to find a written explanation or answer to our question. And that works for a lot of things, but it doesn't work for Zen practice, because Zen practice is necessarily beyond words, beyond ideas, beyond thoughts, beyond anything that can be written down like that or thought about like that. We have to go beyond it. And we're not normally accustomed to doing that unless we've been raised in a subculture of America or by very unusual parents. Children born into this world naturally have that innate wordless curiosity. But usually we get it trained out of ourselves. And by the time we're in grade school, we've learned that what the adults expect of us is words, answers. And that's fine. That's important in terms of getting along in the world of society. But it's useless in terms of getting along in the world of Zen practice. So it takes a great deal of training for us to turn our minds around and let go of the habit patterns of seeking through words and seeking answers, trying to describe, so on and so forth. And then it has to go a little further than that. But the more we can let go, the more we will be able to open to what Wang Po described as this. The master said to me, all the Buddhas and all sentient beings are nothing but the one mind, beside which nothing exists. This mind, and has capital M, which is without beginning, is unborn and indestructible. It is not green nor yellow and has neither form nor appearance. It does not belong to the categories of things which exist or do not exist, nor can it be thought of in terms of new or old. It is neither long nor short, big nor small, for it transcends all limits, measures, names, traces, and comparisons. It is that which you see before you. Begin to reason about it, and you at once fall into error. It is like the boundless void that cannot be fathomed or measured. The one mind alone is the Buddha, and there is no distinction between Buddha and sentient beings. But the sentient beings are attached to forms and so seek externally for Buddhahood. By their very seeking, they lose it, for that is using the Buddha to seek for the Buddha and using mind to grasp mind. Even though they do their utmost for a full eon, they will not be able to attain to it. We should add, not in that way of searching. They do not know that if they put a stop to conceptual thought and forget their anxiety, the Buddha will appear before them. For this mind is the Buddha, and the Buddha is all living things. It is not the less for being manifested in ordinary beings, nor is it greater for being manifested in the Buddhas. And again, he also says, our original Buddha nature is, in highest truth, devoid of any atom of objectivity. It is void, devoid of any atom of objectivity. Because it's pointless to try to seek it through objectivity. It's not a characteristic. You already heard. There are no characteristics. And just like Joshu answered, no, does a dog have a Buddha nature? It doesn't exist, and yet it exists. Now, how can we wrap our mind around that? The deeper you go into your inner search, the more this will make sense to you. And you won't be able to explain it, but it will make sense. Our original Buddha nature is, in highest truth, devoid of any atom of objectivity. It is void, omnipresent, silent, pure. It is glorious and mysterious, peaceful joy. And that is all. Enter deeply into it by awakening to it yourself. That which is before you is it, in all its fullness, utterly complete. There's naught beside. Even if you go through all the stages of a bodhisattva's progress through Buddhahood, one by one, when at last in a single flash you attain to full realization, you will only be realizing Buddha nature, which has been with you all the time. That is why the Tathagata, which is another name for the Buddha, said, I truly attained nothing from complete, unexcelled enlightenment. This Dharma is absolutely without distinctions, neither high nor low, and its name is Bodhi. It is pure mind, which is the source of everything, and which, whether appearing as sentient beings or as Buddhas, as rivers and mountains of the world which has form, as that which is formless, or as penetrating the whole universe, is absolutely without distinctions, there being no such entities as selfness and otherness. Remember Dogen, who said, on returning from China, where he had had a deep awakening experience, to Japan, where he taught until he died of a rather young age of 53, to study the way, in other words, to do practice, to do Zen practice, is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And this is an essential part of our practice. We allow ourselves to be so absorbed that who we think we are disappears. Self-conscious awareness disappears. You know, it's not really that frightening because when we're really involved in a gripping movie, we disappear there too. Or reading an exciting book, the same thing there. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self, that essential step is to become enlightened by the 10,000 things. To be enlightened by the 10,000 things is to remove the barrier between self and other. And that barrier is artificial. It's a construct. Of course, as a child grows, a baby is born, at a certain point, it needs to differentiate and recognize that it's not the same as its mom or dad, whoever the caretaker is. It individualizes, and that's healthy in terms of interaction in society, human interaction. At the same time, form is emptiness. It's important to recognize that in the deeper sense of things, there really is no barrier between self and other. Modern science is beginning to recognize this. When you take our bodies down to a more molecular level, there's no edge to them that says, okay, this is the end of the body, and this is the beginning of the air around it. It's all accumulated molecules, some of them in greater proximity than others, some of them with certain characteristics different from others. But there are no barriers between self and other. This is why human beings have an inborn capacity to feel the emotional state of people around them, even if we're sensitive enough to people long distance, far distance away. There really is no separation. Back to Huang Po. Someone asked him, "From all you've said, mind is Buddha, but it's not clear as to what sort of mind is meant by this mind is Buddha." And Huang Po says, "Well, how many minds have you got?" And the questioner says, "But is Buddha the ordinary mind or the enlightened mind?" Huang Po responds, "Where on earth do you keep your ordinary mind and your enlightened mind?" The questioner says, "In the teaching of the three vehicles, it's stated there are both. Why does your reverence deny it?" And Huang Po says, "In the teaching of the three vehicles, it is clearly explained that the ordinary and enlightened minds are illusions. You don't understand. All this clinging to the idea of things existing is to mistake vacuity for truth. How can such conceptions not be illusory? Being illusory, they hide mind from you. If you would only rid yourselves of the concepts of ordinary enlightened, you would find that there's no other Buddha than the Buddha in your own mind." I would say, it's not even in your own mind. It is your own mind. When Bodhidharma came from the West, he just pointed out that the substance of which all people are composed is the Buddha. You people go on misunderstanding. You hold to concepts such as ordinary, enlightened, directing your thoughts outwards where they gallop about like horses. All this amounts to beclouding your own minds. So I tell you, mind is Buddha. As soon as thought of cessation arises, you fall into dualism. Again, it depends on how you perceive that sensation. Beginningless time and the present moment are the same. There's no doubt, know this and know that. To understand this truth is called complete and unexcelled enlightenment. And this is the practice. These words can be inspiring, perhaps, or confusing. The main point is to extend that out-breath. And if there's confusion, to put that confusion into the out-breath, not as a worded question, but as a wordless experience. Reaching deep within yourself, over and over again. Whatever it is that brought you to practice Zen, whatever it is that brought you to sit on the cushion for 5 days, going with less sleep than you're used to, eating food that may have been different from what you're accustomed to, interacting with other people, tune into that yearning. You don't have to call it anything in particular, just tune into it and let it draw you deep, because that's how you'll reach what you're searching for. That's all you have to do. But you have to persist in doing it. That's the important part. And you have to do it with as deep a level of commitment as possible in each moment. And of course, the more quality time you can spend doing it, the further deeper you'll get. And so I leave you with that. Please take care of yourselves. I won't be back until October, but you can keep the practice going deeper and deeper and deeper. That's up to you. And you can do it. I have no doubt. And I also have no doubt that when you do, it will be truly worth it. And thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.